We just kind of started laying the foundation for the tabernacle and stuff last week. And I put this picture up here again because I don't think people understand what was all taking place. We've got this picture in our mind. Maybe there's a little tabernacle out there, and there's a few tents around there and everything. This, you see just how far out it goes on each side, all the way around that thing, thousands and thousands of tents. That is not an exaggeration. That's an underestimate. Kampala, Uganda only has about 1.2 million people. It swells during the day or during the work week to about 2.5 million. You a while to go across the capital city. How many people, I hear preachers all the time saying how many people was probably there, might have been 2 million, might have been 1 million, might have been, you know, so many. We're going to find out, the Bible tells us exactly how many people there is. Well, pretty much exactly. There's probably between 3 and 4 million Jews at the foot of Mount Sinai or around the tabernacle. And so if you get this in mind, that is not an exaggeration at all. It's actually an under picture of what was actually there. It may seem boring to some people, but God thought it was so important that he not only gave the numbers once in one chapter, he wrote another chapter and gave the numbers again. He really thinks it's that important to us. So what can we learn from the numbers and the tribal arrangements and stuff like this? Most of that is in Numbers chapters 1 through 4. And there's a lot that we could say there, but in Numbers chapter 1, or number 1, chapter 1, verse 3, he gives us the parameters of his census. He starts from 20 years old and upward. That's those that could fight in the military. Now, we have ours down to 18, and it depends on what country you go to. They're different, but in Israel, with God's figuring, he said, I want you to number them from the point that they would be able to go to war from 20 years old and upwards. Now, in chapter 1, we're given the totals of the count of each tribe. Now, I'm not going to go through, I mean, I've got them all written down here, 74,600 in Judah, 54,400 in Issachar, 57,400 in Zebulun. That doesn't make a whole lot of difference to you. So there's 186,400 in those three tribes. There's another three, Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. There's 151,400. You go to Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. There's 108,100. And then Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, there's 157,600. It all totals up 603,000 males that are over 20 years of age. Now, that's not the whole population. That's just the males 20 years old and upward. Okay? Now, in chapter 2, God goes ahead and organizes them by their standard and tribe and gives their numbers all over again. It must be some great importance there. In chapter 3, he sets up the duties of the Levites, and then he numbers the Levites. Even though he says in a normal census, you don't number the Levites. They're a separate tribe, they're for a separate thing, and they're everything's totally different there. But he does number them here from 1 year old and upward as far as the males. And there you come up with 22,000 males of 1 year old and upward. Okay? So that totals 625,550. This is what God says. This is his numbers that he's given. But now, they're leaving a whole lot of people out. You stop and think, there's a lot of people between, a lot of males between birth and 20 years of age. Look at how many young people we got around here that are below the age of 20. And then you got a whole lot of women and things like this and all the kids and there's so much that goes into this. So you've got 625,550 males, and that includes the Levites. So around the tabernacle, you have that many people so far. Now, we come into a slight problem. Whenever you're dealing with Bible, never skirt around and try to cover up problems, because somebody's going to come back and bite you on them. We really have a problem here. The numbers of the Gershonites, there's a difficulty. We see the difficulty in Bible translation, and I'll just show you a little bit about the Bible translation and why it is extremely difficult, even for the Hebrews to translate the Bible, but for us to go back in. And this year we will finish the entire Bible translation in Runyonkore, and they'll begin to publish that here in the next month or so. And it's taken years for us to do that. In Numbers chapter 3 and verse 22, it says that there are 7,500, okay? But it may have been 7,200. You say, are you trying to correct the Bible? No, I'm just pointing out some obvious. There's a problem here. We're not trying to correct the Bible. We're not questioning the Bible, but I want to show you why I say that. It may be very easy to mistake these numbers. For example, Caliph is 500, okay? It just looks like the number 7, doesn't it? Not to the translators, it doesn't. Because notice right up the top, the little red one, you have an exact square, right? A corner, right angle. Down below, see how long it is? All of that makes a difference because the number for 200 is resh. Do you see the difference? The only difference is that top corner is curved a little bit. And it's just a hair shorter, the difference between the number 500 and the number 200. So, how many of you, when you write, are very careful? Even when you're trying, my hand getting pretty shaky. I don't write as good as I used to. Of course, I never did write good, but the downstroke, I may stop a little quicker. Or when I'm going to make a 7, it may almost look like a C or something. That's how difficult this is to translate things in the Bible. Now, the Bible itself has not made a mistake, okay? The number there is exactly what it's supposed to be. But obviously, the translator, when he translated the difference between them, is instead of a 200, he made a 500. But it's corrected later on. The extra 300 is taken off there. In verse number 39, he gives us the total number, which would equal the 22,000, which would make that a 200. We don't question the Word of God. I mean, it's obvious. But don't ever try to pass by little things when you find that there may be just a little twinge in your teaching there, okay? Now, you can take that for what it's worth, but I want to show you, because later on, if you're reading something, you're going to start adding something up, and it doesn't add, and that's why. So, around the tabernacle, in Numbers chapter 1 through 4, there were 625,550 males that were 20 years old and upward, and that includes the Levites. But now you have something else. Marriage was encouraged and even prearranged many times, so most of the people were married. Most of the adult men were married. That's what they pushed. That's what they encouraged. You, there's something wrong with you if you wasn't married, type thing. Okay? So the obvious conclusion, also, there were many widows. People died in battle and different things, and so there were quite a few widows as well. You see them talking about widows all through the Bible. So when we just guesstimate, and this is a guess, if you figure all the people, all the ladies that were married, and then you calculate probably the number of widows that were in that group, I just concluded there was about the same amount. 225,550 widows and wives. Okay? I've gone back and I've tried to find the numbers of families, and they give ideas and things like this, and that's the best estimate I come up with. Then, so there's probably about 600,000 families, roughly. And history tells us that the average Jewish family had between 4 and 8 children. All right? So I'm going to use a low estimate. So the average family of 4 children per family, the total number of the children would be about 2,400,000 kids. Okay? Now, so the total Jewish population that I come up with around the tabernacle is 3,651,100. Now, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Bloomington have almost that same amount, 3,712. Tampa, Clearwater, and Petersburg, Florida has 3,342,000, so odd people. San Diego, Chula Vista, and Carlsbad have 3,269,000. Denver, Aurora, and Centennial, they have only 3 million. And these are vast areas, huge cities. So when you're thinking about when they come to Sinai and the Mount Sinai, you have to have a place, a huge place, for them to camp. There, at that Mount Sinai that they have down in the Egyptian peninsula, there's no place for hardly 1,000 people to camp, let alone 3.6 million. But at Mount Sinai over in Egypt, where we've shown you before, there is plenty of room. when they camped at Pihahiroth before they go across the sea there, there is a place that will hold plenty of these people, over 3 million people like that. So when you're thinking and you're calculating, all of these numbers come into perspective, and you have to make them fit. And that's why you can throw out your maps, a lot of them, because they're bogus. There's no way that it could ever be that way. Then we come to the arrangement of the camp around the tabernacle. Now think with me, a massive slave group has left Egypt. They're in a great hurry. They're running for their lives. They're getting out of Dodge. They've just had this big feast. God has performed some miracles and killed all the firstborn in Egypt. And they say, let's go. And we think in our mind, how many of you have seen the Ten Commandment movie? Okay? They all get their standards and they're all organized and they're marching out and everything wrong. They weren't ever put in these categories until they got to Mount Sinai. That's one of the reasons God brought them to Mount Sinai. There had to be some organization because there was no organization. It was chaos. So he paused at Mount Sinai not just for religious reasons, but for organizational reasons as well. The society need to be organized out of chaos. So God instructed Moses to count and to tax each adult male, 20 years old and over. This tax was to be paid at the tabernacle and was called the atonement money. And we see that later on. Every male had to pay the same amount, a half shekel. Anybody know how much a half shekel's worth? About $5.50. Wasn't a big tax. But we're slaves going to get $5.50. God provided it to them when they came out of Egypt. It said they spoiled Egypt. And God gave them all of those things. He gave them the silver, the gold, the brass, the money, the clothes, all of these things, so that they were well able to build the tabernacle, to pay the tax, and not hurt them at all. So God has provided this. Now from this point, the tabernacle then is the center of the Israelite camp. The 12 tribes of Israel camped in a special arrangement. God made the arrangement. And so as we look at the arrangement, it tells us different things, and it shows us, teaches us things. Remember, everything about the tabernacle has to do with Jesus Christ. It is a type all the way through. So Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, they're on the east side of the tabernacle under the standard of the lion. He gives them the standard of the lion, and they're supposed to follow under that. These tribes made up the largest of the four groups, 186,400. Then on the west side of the tabernacle, under the standard of the ox, were tribes of Benjamin, Manasseh, and Ephraim. They were the smallest number. Then on the south side, under the standard of the man, there were three tribes of Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. And on the north side of the other standard was the eagle. And there was Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. Both north and south camps were about the same size, 157,000, something like that. And the total equaled 603,550 males. And he goes on and he goes back again. And he numbers these tribes of the Levites and Aaron and all this. Now, the Gospels in the New Testament present Christ in his incarnation, in his life, in his death, in his resurrection. All of these things are in play here. So on the north side, you have Matthew. Matthew, represented by the eagle, presents Christ as the king. When you read the book of Matthew, he proclaims him, basically, the book is showing him as the king, his lineage, everything, all of that. Then on the west side, it's represented by the ox, and that's the book of Mark. It presents Christ as the suffering servant. And as you read Mark, that's what you see, this Jesus as the suffering servant. And then on the south side, you have Luke. It represented by man, and it presents Christ as the sinless Son of Man, over and over, claiming to be the Son of Man, that prophesied one. And then on the east side, you see where it's John, the book of John, and that's represented by the lion. Strength, power, deity. And that's what John portrays in his picture. But to get the picture, you almost have to zoom out, okay? And when you zoom out, this is what you see. Notice at the bottom, you enter through the door to get into the tabernacle compound. Then you go and make the sacrifice, the acceptable sacrifice at the brazen altar. Then you go to the brazen laver for cleansing. Then they would go into the tabernacle and they would see the light of the world, Jesus, the only light in the temple. And then the bread of life, he sustains us and takes care of us. The prayers of the saints in the altar of incense, and how it represents us coming before a holy God, but there's still something separating us, and that is that curtain. Once our sacrifice has come, once everything is in place, we can go through that curtain to the very presence of God at the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant. It's a picture of the cross, the entire tabernacle. It fits perfectly as God's trying to give us and portray Jesus Christ and what was coming here. Now, the furniture inside and outside of the tabernacle, they all fit together. You don't just separate them, they're all together, and that's why they form the message and the cross, all of those things. Now, the tabernacle was built in 1440 BC. So, it was used from the time of the Exodus until the time of King Solomon, when Solomon's temple was built around 957. Then, that makes a conclusion, we can understand that it was used for around 480 years. The tabernacle was in use. It's a long time for this thing to be carried around and taken down and put up and taken down and put up and carried around and all these different things. But for 480 years, this was their means of coming to God. Now, when we talk about the tabernacle, there's many different measurements that we'll talk about. All kinds of measurements, different things. Several different measurements used in the Bible, like a span or a rod or the cubit. And the cubit is the standard biblical measurement. And this is how he tells us to build the tabernacle, by using the cubits. But we have a little bit of a problem here because there's different types of cubits. For example, and I'll just convert these to inches for you. The Hebrew short cubit was 17 and a half inches. The Egyptian short cubit was a 17 and 6 inches. The common short cubit was 18 inches. The Babylonian cubit was 19.8 inches. The Hebrew long cubit was 20.4. And when you go on and you start reading articles and studying them, you'll find out they're using different calculations, using different standards. So you've got to know which one they're using. And for our study, you've got the Egyptian long cubit, that's 20.6. For our study, we used the standard 18-inch cubit. That's the common short cubit that we use pretty much throughout the scriptures. It's actually from the tip of your fingers down here. And on the average man, it was 18 inches. Now, if you're a short man, you might have one like the Hebrew cubit, a little shorter. And if you're a big guy, you know, it might be the Egyptian. But the standard cubit is only 18 inches, and that's what we'll use. This is the tabernacle.
And thou shalt make the court of the tabernacle for the south side southward. There shall be hangings for the court of fine twined linen, of 100 cubits long for one side, and the 20 pillars thereof, and their 20 sockets shall be of brass. The hooks of the pillars and their fillets shall be of silver. And likewise for the north side in length, there shall be hangings of 100 cubits long, and his 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of brass, the hooks of the pillars and their fillets of silver. And for the breadth of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits, their pillars 10 and their sockets 10. And the breadth of the court on the east side eastward shall be 50 cubits. The hangings of one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, their pillars 3 and their sockets 3. And on the other side shall be hangings 15 cubits, their pillars 3 and their sockets 3. And for the gate of the court shall be an hanging of 20 cubits, of blue and purple and scarlet, and fine twined linen, wrought with needlework. And their pillars shall be 4, and their sockets 4. All the pillars round about the court shall be filleted with silver. Their hooks shall be of silver, and their sockets of brass. And the length of the court shall be 100 cubits, and the breadth 50 everywhere, and the height 5 cubits of fine twined linen, and their sockets of brass. All the vessels of the tabernacle in all the service thereof, and all the pins thereof, and all the pins of the court shall be of brass.
Most of that is biblical. I just lost my leg. Most of it is biblical. Some of it's not. I have written to some of the most renowned scholars all these last months, and not one of them could give me an answer. If you have 20 pillars, okay, in between each pillar is 5 cubits, right? You have how many openings? 19. 19 times 5 is not 100 cubits. If you do the end and there's 10 poles, you have 9 openings, 5 cubits in between each opening. That's not 50 cubits. I'm going to show you why later on. This is an aerial view from my Old Testament drone that I had, and it kind of gives you an overview here. I wish they'd have had one at Trump rally, but this entire dimension, I really want you to understand what we're talking about. The tabernacle itself, not the courtyard, the tabernacle. I've measured this. It starts right here. Okay? The entire tabernacle is only this long. The tabernacle itself starts right here as far as the width. And it stops right here. We was talking this morning about why they didn't take the staves out of the Ark of the Covenant when they got it in the Holy of Holies. It wasn't room. You've got the Ark of the Covenant in here, and it's sitting in here, and you've got the staves coming out these sides that they're going to have to pick that thing up and carry it. You got a wall there and a wall here. You can't take it out. We have this concept of the tabernacle that Solomon built. This huge monstrous of buildings and just huge temple type things. The entire tabernacle was only this big. You put the whole thing right on this stage. So in getting a hold of these things, I'm trying to get you a picture in your mind that you can understand why certain things were done, how things were done, and how all this fits together. For example, it was 100 cubits from on the outer court from the end pole to the end pole. Okay? 100 cubits. Now, there's 50 cubits. That's actually the length was 150 feet, and that would be from in here into the other auditorium for the entire courtyard. So it's 100 cubits or 150 feet on the side, and it's 50 cubits or 75 feet on the end. Then you have the tabernacle itself is only 45 feet long. Okay? It's 15 feet wide, and it's 15 feet tall. When you get to the Holy of Holies, it is a square. It is 15 by 15 by 15. What's the New Jerusalem? A square. And all these different things, God begins to, we'll cover all this, but I'm just kind of whetting your appetite here a little bit. So, the holy place is 30 feet by 45 feet. Where the candle and the stick and all of this is only probably from here to there. They have the candle, the showbread, the altar of incense, all of that. That's all the room they had to work inside that temple or that tabernacle. So as you try to get the picture of this, this is not a huge structure. Now, 30 feet for the holy place, 15 feet wide, 15 feet in length for the Holy of Holies, and the height is 15 feet. Now, this is my aerial drone with the infrared X-ray vision thing here, okay? You see, in this you have the candlestick, the lampstand, the table of showbread on this side. Further down, you have the altar of incense. And then in the Holy of Holies, you have the Ark of the covenant and the mercy seat. They're two different things. The colors of the tabernacle are important, and we'll go through a lot of this. In the Bible, these colors and materials have symbolic meaning. Now, there's nothing in God's word that is without significance. Every word, every color, every number, every name is rich with the layers of meaning that go with these things. It's just tremendous. And you don't have to make it say something. It says it. And God put certain things here and there. And as we get into some of the coverings and the seal skins and all this, which are not seal skins at all, and whoa, it's going to be fun. White pictures that Christ's righteousness, holiness, purity, light, truth. That's why the entire outside, the when you're looking in at the entire tabernacle compound, all you see is white. That's what God wanted us to see, the purity. That's what separates us from God. It's also used to make the veils and conceal and protect the sacred spaces and priestly garments and things like this. We'll get into all this in detail. John's vision in the book of Revelation links the white linen with that same concept of purity. The spotlessness of the Lamb and the high priest's garments are in stark contrast to our filthiness, our worthless, filthy garments, fallen humanity. That's what we are. And when we come into that area of purity, that purity stands out. And there's several verses you could go to. We'll just cover this just briefly. The blue represents heaven. The blue represents heaven, eternal things, faithfulness. You can look at Exodus chapter 24 and verse number 10, tremendous passage on this. The origin of the biblical blue dye and its processing techniques, it's very interesting. The blue dye is obtained from the yellow secretions discovered in the glands of a particular sea mollusk common in the Middle East. The secretions of these mollusks turn purple when exposed to the air. When exposed to sunlight, it turns blue. It takes about 12,000 snails to make 1.4 grams of dye, making it precious, rare, and expensive. It's said to be worth its weight in gold. The purple meant something. The blue meant something. All of these colors, the white, meant something. The scarlet, obviously, pictures the ransom of Jesus Christ, the sacrifice, his blood. Scarlet has to do with humankind and the lifeblood that sustains them. That's why Leviticus says the life of the flesh is in the blood. That's talking about life here. The Hebrew for man is Adam and is spelled exactly the same as the word for red. The Hebrew word for scarlet is toletha, sheni. A tola, the creature from which the dye represents red blood is obtained. The tola is a worm or a maggot known from its crimson worm, known as the crimson worm, and its life cycle illustrates man's salvation through a perfect sacrificial blood of Christ on our behalf. There's so much that you could go into. I'm just throwing a few things in there. I've got so much material, I don't want to even try to cover it. But the purple combines the colors scarlet and blue. It pictures royalty, wealth, and power. Like the blue, this dye is also obtained from that sea mullet. It was difficult to obtain and therefore rare and costly. I want to bring that out to you. Everything in this tabernacle, God didn't go to the secondhand store. He didn't say, okay, if you got something left over, bring it. God did not spare any expense on his things, on this tabernacle. God has, he owns the hills. He owns the gold in them. He owns everything. Money's nothing to God. And God gives it to us, as and we become caretakers of what he gives us. And God promises blessings through our giving. Now, the blue, scarlet, purple are the three colors most frequently used in the fabric of the tabernacle. Blue represents the Holy of Holies, where God dwelt with, or between, rather, the cherubim. And the purple represents the holy place where the mediating work of the priesthood occurred. No individual outside of a priest could go into that tabernacle. None of Israel ever saw the inside of the tabernacle. Only the priests could enter in. The scarlet represents the outer court where the sacrifices took place. You have the white, the blue, the scarlet, the purple. The materials of the tabernacle are also costly. You have gold. Gold is the most precious metal. Its value is just tremendous. It contrasts humanity, wood, and the most precious thing that existed. It's the symbol of the heavenly. That which is eternal. It speaks of the righteousness of God, the glory of his personhood, and his mercy. It speaks of his deity and his kinship of Jesus Christ. He was God, yet man. Therefore, it pictures the divine nature, the purity, the holiness, and the eternal value, which is the very essence of God. Then you come to silver. A ransom is not without cost. Silver is the symbol of redemption and truth, of the soul being ransomed by the atonement money. The atonement money was gathered, and then they would take that atonement money and melt it down, and then make these different objects from it. It was illustrated in the New Covenant as the price paid for the betrayal of Jesus Christ for our ransom. The silver was the foundation that undergirded the entire holy place connected with the Holy of Holies. So much that we could say, we come to brass. Copper or brass concerns God's judgment of sin. Brass, bronze is a symbol of strength and judgment in respect to the judgment God placed on Christ for sin. As we look into this, you see the brazen altar and the brazen laver and all of this. It all spoke of judgment. That's why the very foundation of the courtyard was on the sockets of brass. Everything, the foundation of your salvation and mine, has to do with judgment, which tells us we are sinners and we will die without Jesus Christ one day. There's no way we can cover all this morning. We'll go ahead and close here. But as we get into this, I'm covering these things so you can get a picture. When you see, when we talk about the blue or the scarlet or all these things, it will start meaning something as we go through it. Father, we thank you for your love. Ask you to bless the hour to come, the whole day as we serve and worship you today. May you be honored in Jesus' name. Amen.